Okay, roll call, please.
Terry Brown.
Here.
Mark Brunner.
Here.
Jim Carroll.
Here.
Michelle LeBeau.
Here.
Judy Dorsett. Greg Hagan.
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick is excused. Bud Harvey.
Here.
Bill Klein.
Here.
Jason Antrim.
Here.
Cindy Pena.
Here.
Albert Richard. Brian Rossi. Paula Ryan is excused. Chelsea Slendery.
Here.
Deborah Carlson.
Thank you. We need a motion to adopt the agenda.
So moved.
The thing is, we need to, we're going to have a reorder of the agenda, have information item 3D heard after item 3A, and then 3B will end. So with that.
So moved with the changes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We need a motion to approve the minutes of February 5th.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
There are no comments from the chair. Jason, will you review the content?
Yeah, sure. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Price.
Can't hear you.
I don't know if it's up loud enough.
Or,
so,
just to go over a few items on our liaison report. First thing, it's Florida Bicycle Month. That's this month, the month of March. And we have a Bike to Work Day ride on Friday, March 20th. So if anybody's interested, I think we're collaborating with a few others, the city of West Palm Beach, and we'll be taking a ride from the Tri-Rail station to the downtown. So if you have the day free, or the morning at least, if you're downtown, come out and join us. Then also there's a Palm Beach County Mobility Planning Study, Planning Summit, and that's planned for April 1st from 8:30 to 4 p.m., so it'll be an all-day event, and that'll be right here in the Palm Beach County Convention Center. And due to that event, we'll be changing the CAC meeting date, and that meeting date will be April 3rd, which will be on a Friday as opposed to our normally scheduled Wednesday meeting. So with those changes, there's also the last thing is the TPA funding. We had the local initiatives and transportation alternatives grant programs. The last date to apply was February 28th. We received quite a few applications, and they're all listed on the back. You'll see that there's a third category. So although everybody applied under local initiatives and transportation alternatives, we are looking at a different component for state road, making modifications on the state road as a third category. So we'll see that develop in the months to come, and you'll see all of these projects scored and ranked in July when I bring them back to all the committees. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any comments from the general public? Seeing there is none, let's move on. There's no action items on this agenda, so 3A will be next. And that's I-95 at Lantana Road, a project development environmental study with a diverging diamond. Interchange.
Good afternoon. My name is Godfrey Lamte. I'm the consultant project manager for the I-95 at Lantana Road PD&E study. And I also have with me here Vandana Nagol. She's the FDOT project manager for this project. I'll be presenting the various alternatives that we considered as part of this project, and then also the recommendations that we have. And after that, we'll go into any questions that you have. So basically, this project was actually identified as one of the interchanges that required improvement after the feasibility study that was done and completed in December of 2014, where it basically studied 17 interchanges along I-95 in Palm Beach County. This is actually one of the last ones that is going through the PD&E phase currently. So the project, as I mentioned, is a located at the interchange of Lantana Road with I-95. It's also within the town of Lantana in Palm Beach County. Basically, for I-95, we're looking at a limit that extends just from north of Hypoluxa Road to south of South Avenue South. I-95 within this area is a 10-lane urban interstate. It's also part of the national highway system. It's also a strategic intermodal system and an emergency evacuation route as well. For Lantana Road, this is basically the limits that we're looking at is from High Ridge Road all the way to Andrew Redding Road. It is a 4-lane urban principal arterial. It's also under the jurisdiction of the county and also has a part of it as an emergency evacuation route that is from US 1 to I-95. So the purpose of this project basically is to improve the local and regional transportation network and also to enhance the intermodal relationships within the I-95 interchange area. The primary criteria that we're looking at is basically to reduce the congestion and improve the interchange operations, basically to avoid any traffic spillback going into I-95 in the future. The other thing we're also looking at is to improve the safety conditions by reducing conflicts at the interchange, and then also to make sure that we can accommodate the future traffic demand, that is the future traffic growth within the area. From a secondary criteria, we're looking to improve multimodal connectivity, also improve freight access as well, then also enhance the emergency evacuation within this area as well. So this slide here basically shows you the level of service criteria that we use to evaluate various improvements within any roadway improvement that we undertake. Basically, the level of service is a standard measure, which is based on the delays that you experience as you drive on the roadways, and then also the speed. Now, the level of service goes from level of service A to level of service F, with A being the best and the F being the worst. For the DOT, this being a DOT project, FDOT project, the target that the DOT has established is the level of service D for the future year, that is 2045. We're not talking about currently. We're talking about 2045. That is, we project 20 years after we anticipate when the project is going to be open to the public. This slide also shows the existing conditions as well as the no action, that is, if you don't do anything for the project. So currently, most of the intersections that we are looking at, various intersections, we're looking at High Ridge Road, Sunset Road, the two ramp terminals, the Shopping Center Drive, and Andrew Redding's Road. Basically, six intersections along Lantana Road. And currently, most of them are operated at level of service D or better. However, if you don't do anything within the future year, that is the 2045 future year, you're going to experience level of service F for most of the intersections. And that's what is driving the need to be able to do something within these interchanges to make sure that we can accommodate the future traffic demand that is anticipated for this location. One of the things that we always do as part of any PD&E project is to make sure that we look at what happens if we don't do anything. The no action alternative is always an alternative that we consider as part of this any PD&E study. It also serves as a baseline to compare the various build alternatives that we develop for the project. Now, for this project, we did develop three different build alternatives. The first one is the tight urban diamond interchange configuration. The second one is the divergent diamond interchange. And the third one is what we call the single point urban interchange. Now, for all these three alternatives, what we also included is the transportation system management and operations improvements. Now, these are basically ITS improvements that we actually tag on to any of these build alternatives to make sure that we are optimizing the existing facilities as they are. And some of the things that we're looking at are incident management cameras, CCTV cameras, runway detection technology, you know, vehicle detection systems, and also dynamic message signs along I-95, both east and west of I-95. So this slide here basically shows you the build alternative. One, as I mentioned, this is the tight urban diamond interchange configuration. Basically, it maintains what is there right now. What is there right now is your tight urban diamond configuration. But we do add a number of improvements to that. One of the first things that we did was to add an extra lane both in the eastbound and westbound direction of Lantana Road. So currently, as I mentioned, it is a 4-lane urban principal arterial. and that is we're increasing that to a six-lane urban principal arteria between High Ridge Road and Andrew Redding Road. The other things also that we've done as part of this interchange improvement is to add additional lanes for the ramps. Basically, we have triple right turns and double left turns.
Would you mind using the pointer on that one? Because then we can kind of see you and see them.
Okay, all right. So basically for this alternative, the other thing we add in also is the triple right and the double left for both the southbound as well as the northbound ramp terminals. We also are providing double left turns going both east and the west to get onto I-95. And then also, we have improvements at the High Ridge Road. We are adding an extra right-hand lane for both the northbound and the southbound directions. So as you can see, the level of service, what you see on each of these is the level of service that we have at the various intersections. For the most part, we are obtaining level of service a D or better for the overall intersections. However, there are some. When you look at the individual movements, that is like the southbound movements, we do experience level of service F for those ones, and that is something we need to take into consideration as we evaluate the various alternatives. The other thing also that I wanted to mention is that for all the alternatives, we do have bike lanes, 7-foot buffered bike lanes on each side of the roadway, and then we also have 6-foot sidewalks along the entire corridor as well between High Ridge Road and Andrew Redding's Road. Now, going to build alternative 2, which is a divergent diamond interchange configuration. Now, this alternative basically reconfigures the existing tight urban diamond that we have here. Basically, what it does is if you're going eastbound, you're going to go here, switch over to the next side through this signalized intersection, and then you have another one here, and then you come back down over here. The same thing if you're going in the opposite direction, you switch over to the opposite side of the roadway and then come over to the other side. Now, the advantage of this is that...
The northbound traffic on I-95 that wants to go west?
Yes. So you can still make. So you're going over here, you make a turn here, and then you go over here. Go west.
Now, the traffic that's going westbound that wants to go south,
so that will go this way, and then they'll make a...
Westbound.
They'll come here, come down here, and go down this way.
So there's a conflict between the people going north who want to go west with the people that are coming west who wants to go south.
They are all signalized, so they don't operate with this. They have different phasing. Okay. So the advantage of this this interchange configuration is that it basically reduces your typical phase. Now, if you look at what I talked about in the previous alternative, that is a tight urban diamond. You have four phases. So the north, the left turns will go, and then the through movement goes, and then you switch over to the other side, the lefts go in the opposite direction, and then the through movement goes. Now, with this interchange configuration, what you have is you reduce the four phase to only two phases. So you only have those going that way and those going that way. And all the other movements are synchronized with those two movements. So basically, there is no conflict. In fact, this interchange configuration basically reduces the number of conflict points. And one of the things that actually makes these interchange operations congested is the left turns. That when you're going left here in the mornings, they are always congested. It's very hard to make this left. Now, with this configuration, as you come over here, this becomes a free flow, and you go free. So these provide tremendous improvement, operational improvement, when you compare it to what we have right now. Even with the existing tight urban diamond adding additional lanes, the operational improvement, as you can see, the level of service here, these are all level of service Cs, which is a lot better than what you have for build alternative 1. So from an operational standpoint, this operates a lot better. And also, these ramps do not back up onto the I-95 mainline, which is one of the critical things that we're looking at on this project. So from an operational standpoint, this provides tremendous improvements in terms of the mobility within the interchange area. The other big improvement that you have is the safety. From a safety standpoint also, alternative 2 provides much higher safety improvements. As I mentioned to you, there's a lot less congestion. People going over here have a free flow. Down here also have a free flow. And if you're coming off from the ramps, you just get over here and then also over here to get back on that. The safety, when you compare, you're looking at about a 40% reduction in crashes for this alternative versus about 15% for build alternative 1. So from both an operational and safety standpoint, you have very good improvements for this alternative. Now, the third alternative is what we call the single-point urban interchange. Basically, it's very similar to build alternative 1. The main difference here you have is that you actually, instead of having two signals at the ramp terminal, you actually combine it into a single intersection. So you are able to make all the movements that you would currently make, but at only one signalized intersection instead of two. Okay. So the advantage you have here is that you actually have some improvements in the traffic operations. Now, when you compare all the three different alternatives, build alternative 2, as I mentioned, operates best from an operational standpoint, followed by 3 and then 1 in that order. The other thing that I also wanted to mention, and I'm probably going to go back one, is this right-of-way that is required to, in order to make these improvements. We have right-of-way at the Lantana self-storage, right-of-way impact at the Costco minor right-of-way here, and then also we have right-of-way impact. All the magenta that you see, those are right-of-way impact. There's also a Shell gas station that we have over here that will be impacted as part of this project. Now, all the build alternatives have right-of-way impacts. Similar to this, you also have right-of-way impact as well to the Lantana shopping center as well as the gas station. The main difference is that for the gas station, build alternative 2 has a much bigger impact on the gas station than build alternatives 1 and 3. Now, from an environmental standpoint, this project is within an urbanized area, so there are very minimal impacts from an environmental standpoint. From a socioeconomic, we have, as I mentioned, there's 10 right-of-way impacts to property, commercial properties. We also looked at access modifications to the Sunset Road intersection to make it safer. And then also, there's going to be some loss of parking due to the right-of-way impact we have at the Lantana Shopping Center. As I already mentioned, the one gas station that we have along the corridor is going to have an impact, which is considered a high-risk site as well. The existing noise walls along I-95 will be maintained as part of this project. There are no new noise walls that have been recommended. From a cultural resources standpoint, the railroad, CSX, the South Florida Rail Corridor, is considered a national register eligible, and we'll make sure that we are maintaining the envelope that you have there. There's also one site that was identified that may be considered eligible because it was built back in the 60s, and that is there's a Chase building that is over here right next to the gas station. So we're currently looking at that to see if that would be eligible for the National Register. From a natural resources standpoint, we do not anticipate any impact to wetlands or any federal or state species. So this slide here basically shows you the comparison of the various alternatives. Now, as I mentioned, build alternative 2, from an operational standpoint, is the best. Same with the safety. Also, with the pedestrians and bicycles, this can also provide various improvements that is reducing the number of conflict points you have within the interchange for bicycles and the pedestrians. From an access standpoint, we can also provide additional improvements at the Sunset Road intersection as for both alternatives 2 and 3, so that makes them a lot more attractive from that standpoint. From an aesthetic standpoint, we have a lot of green area for the diverging diamond, so that makes it also very conducive to be able to provide more landscape within that area as well. Now, from an environmental standpoint, as you can see, this is a medium. Because of the more significant impacts to the Shell gas station that you have. When you look at the right-of-way cost estimates, For build alternative 1 and 3, they are practically the same. The right-of-way impacts are the same. However, the build alternative 2 has a much higher right-of-way impact due to the fact that there's more significant impacts to the Shell gas station as well. Construction costs, we have $16.5 million for build alternative 1, 26.2 for build alternative 2, and 23.3 for build alternative 3. However, when you look at the benefit-cost ratio, we see that alternative 2 has the highest benefit-cost ratio. And the main reason being that if you take the safety benefits that you get from build alternative 2 and then compare it with the cost, it far outweighs the other two alternatives. In terms of the project, meeting the project alternatives, as I mentioned, build alternative 1 still has some residual queues that tends to extend to the I-95 mainline. So we do not, this does not meet the project objectives to eliminate all those spillback onto I-95. However, the other two meet the project alternatives for the improvements. We did a lot of public involvement as part of this project. We started the project back in January of last year. We had a public kickoff meeting in May of last year. We also had an alternative public workshop in November of last year. And we have an upcoming public hearing scheduled for summer of this year. We also met with the town of Lantana mayor as well as the town manager on two occasions. We met with the previous Palm Beach County mayor as well, and also with the Greater Lantana Chamber of Commerce. And then also we met with the TPA staff as well for this project. We've also had other meetings with some of the major stakeholders along the corridor. I will continue the outreach process throughout the study. So in conclusion, what we are recommending is to go with the build alternative 2, that is the divergent diamond interchange configuration, as the preferred alternative. And it's basically due to what I have already explained in the previous slides. It has the highest level of mobility and safety improvements. It also provides the highest benefit-cost ratio, making it the most cost-effective. And it also allows us to, you know, be able to accommodate future managed lanes along I-95. If we have to replace the bridges, we can actually accommodate any future managed lanes that goes on I-95. There's also a lot of improvements in terms of bicycles and pedestrians within the build alternative 2 as well. We're adding bicycle lanes, which is not there currently. And then also it provides additional opportunities for landscape and aesthetic improvements. And it has the highest public support based on the public meetings that we've had so far. Build alternative 2 has always come up as the preferred alternative from a public standpoint. In terms of the funding and the schedule, as I already mentioned, the project we began last year. We're looking to go to public hearing in July of this year, and then allocation design and concept acceptance in March, April of next year. Following that, we'll go on to the design phase and the right-of-way phase, which would probably occur concurrently between 2020 and 2023. And then construction, currently the construction dollars are programmed for fiscal year 2029. And this here shows you what we currently have in the funding, in the TIP funding. We have approximately $2 million for design, $7.8 for right-of-way, and $21.6 for construction on this corridor. These are the contact information that I mentioned earlier, myself and Vandana. So with that, if there's any question.
Yeah, I've got a couple.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say I got a couple of questions from my previous life that mostly come around Sunset Road.
Yeah.
What are the specific access modifications you're talking about for Sunset Road?
Okay. So we've been looking at a lot of different improvements at Sunset Road, and this has been one of the biggest topics. Anytime we go for public meetings, we've had a number of public meetings. And when we started looking at this project, and you look at the entire Lantana Road, okay, from High Ridge Road to Andrew Redding Road, the bulk of the crashes, about two-thirds of the crashes, occurs within this area here. Why? Because there's a lot. This is the Costco. There's a lot of people going in and out of the Costco, and this Sunset Road is one of their main, access points to get there. So people make this movement, they cross three lanes, make a U-turn here to get back to I-95. And then there's also an existing left turn that goes into the Costco. So one of the things that we're looking at, basically, when we started looking at this project from the beginning, was we need to reduce the number of conflict points because there's so many crashes here. And one of the ways to reduce the number of to reduce crashes is to eliminate some of the movements and provide them elsewhere. So we did take out the eastbound left turn, and then for this improvement, we're looking at having them go on High Ridge Road to be able to access. The Costco has another access point, just not of.
My concern particularly is on the south side, the Salt Waste Authority transfer station, because that's all big vehicles.
Yes.
And they all have, almost all of them make a left turn going out of there.
So one of the other things that we've looked at, and I'm sorry, the batteries have run out of this, so I cannot really show. But we're looking at another improvement to make it a lot better. We're looking at an access underpass. So basically, what we're looking at is there's a frontage road on that connects to the Sunset Road, and then there's also one that goes to the Solid Waste Authority. If you connect these roadways underneath the bridge, okay, if you replace the bridge and you connect them, and all of a sudden, people can actually use that underpass roadway and make the same movement, but avoiding the issues you have avoiding the issues you have with the Sunset Road and the High Ridge Road intersection.
I guess then the next thing to just bring it to closure, have you done any public outreach to the Solid Waste Authority?
We are actually in the process of scheduling a meeting with them to talk to them about that. And the reason why you don't see that access road is we're actually still evaluating that. There's some right-of-way impacts that you're going to have some right-of-way impacts to the Costco over here. They have a generator here, and the roadway, the underpass basically is right in the footprint of that generator. So now we are currently in the process of scheduling meetings with them to discuss, you know, how can we accommodate that. That underpass roadway is a very good solution to the problems you have over here. The other thing also is there are five residential properties over here, and they've always complained about the fact that the traffic from the Costco even sometimes blocks them from getting out of their properties. So that access road basically would make, you can actually come over here if you want to get to I-95, you come here, you turn over here, go underneath here, come over here, and go through here to get to I-95. You basically don't have to get onto a High Ridge Road. If you want to go east from, there was an existing east to north here, you can come here, go through here, go underneath here, and get back to the Costco. So that would actually make a very good improvement to that. We're still, as I mentioned, it's still something that we're evaluating. We had a meeting this morning with the TAC, the access to come back, to present that as well. So that is something that we're looking very closely now. And we'll be talking to the adjacent property owners to see how we can make that.
Because that outreach will be important because the kind of traffic specifically from that facility is the kind of traffic a lot of people don't like.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
for sure.
So, you know, it's heavy collection vehicles, and so depending on where you route them, it may be very easy from a traffic standpoint, but very bad from a public perception standpoint.
Who's next?
Jim.
Yeah, I had a question about this particular divergent diamond, I guess you call it. I think the glades, the proposed glades redo also employed that kind of pattern. Is there any existing already built intersection that uses diverging diamond in the county?
Not in the county at the moment, not in Palm Beach County.
Okay.
But there is one that is programmed for 45th Street, but I think it's in design. They already finished the PD&E.
Right. Yeah, I'm just curious whether there was one.
But there is there's two actually in Miami-Dade County currently in operation. Yeah.
I've seen one of these up farther north, and I wonder, especially at nighttime, any reports of problems of people who are heading towards each other before the weaves occur?
You're talking about people going in the opposite direction?
Right. There's traffic coming to the west, and then traffic going to the east, which until they get close to the interchange, the stoplight, appear to be coming straight at each other. So, at night, when you see less of the infrastructure and you just see darkness, it gives the appearance that cars are headed right for you. I've had this experience in some intersection farther north of the state, and I wondered whether that, apparently that doesn't give you a big problem since you rated it highly has that been reported as a problem at all?
That hasn't been an issue that has been of a significant feature in this divergent diamond. In actual fact, the safety numbers that have been reported have been tremendous. You know, anywhere from 40 to 60 or even sometimes even 70% reduction in crashes. The wrong way issue that you're talking about has not occurred. I don't think there's, based on the research that I've read, as well as looking at how these have been operating in Miami, that hasn't been an issue. But for the nighttime, the issue has been with the glare, you know, because there's you're coming almost at the same level in opposite direction has been the glare. So there have been areas where, you know, they've actually put some anti-glare screenings to try to reduce that effect. So that is something that we can look at as part of this project as well.
Thank you.
I have a couple of quick questions. Wouldn't it make more sense if you could do it to just purchase those properties where you go into Costco off of Highwood Road so that you have more room for the access point? You know where I'm talking about? There's two or three houses. There's a business on the other side of the road, I think a daycare center.
Yeah, that's a daycare center.
But the other ones are not businesses.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I know you don't want to go to court and take them from them, but it seems like the state could make offers for that property, and it would give you a lot more access points for turnaround or whatever. Has anyone considered that?
Well, currently, based on the designs we have, we do not anticipate, you know, taking those properties.
But they are going to be boxed in there no matter what you do.
It's from an improvement standpoint, we have not... We've tried to avoid the, you know, minimize right away because we don't want to have too much impact, particularly to residents. Maybe somebody has been there for 20, 30 years. That is his, you know, place of residence. And you have all these sentimental, you know, things associated with the building. So we try to avoid right away as much as possible. And that's what we've done as part of this project. But, you know, I do understand your point.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to comment on is that I've taken that road, I-95, since it opened. I worked for the state of Florida and had responsibilities at the old A.G. Holly State Hospital. And going up that ramp, this ramp going south, when you get up on the top of the ramp and you make the left on the Lantana Road, those ramps move. They vibrate. And they still do it to this day. And this is after you did improvements. And I don't know if anyone's ever experienced it, but you can be on top of that ramp and you can feel the damn thing moving. And this construction alternative 2 would solve that problem because it would be on solid base?
Well, I would say this would solve that problem. And the reason why I'm going to explain.
You agree, though, it's still vibrating. Have you been there?
Bridges do have a little movement because if you make them too rigid, then you
see. Oh, I know. They say it's natural.
But to explain what we're doing as part of this is there is a bridge over here, and there's also a bridge down here. Those are the two bridges you're talking about. We're actually replacing them. You know, so we're going to be replacing those. We're not going to be putting back bridges, but we're going to be putting up walls.
Yeah.
You know, for that, as part of this improvement. So you're not going to have those bridges standing alone by themselves.
Yeah.
And so it would take care of that.
It's a little scary being up there when there's a lot of traffic.
Are you walking or is your car moving?
No, on the car, it actually moves.
Okay.
He'll tell you. He's smiling. He knows. The whole structure moves.
I've actually walked on a bridge before, so I know how it feels.
have a question. Have you taken into consideration the huge amount of retail and residential that's going to be added to Water Tower Commons?
Yeah.
And one, the that's one. Two, and the Andrews Redding Road, that left turn lane is still only a single lane. I mean, that's going to back up to the bridge by itself.
So we did take the traffic. If you remember the slide that I talked to you about, the existing condition slide, and let me go back quickly to that. So this slide here, if you look at it right now, most of the intersections are operating at a fairly good level of service, D or better. Okay, but with the Water Tower Commons developments
can you point on the other screen so we can
I'm sorry. With the Water Tower Commons development that is coming in, that is adding a lot of traffic onto this interchange. That's why you see all these intersections are failing within the design here. So, yes, we have considered the traffic from the Water Tower Commons development as part of this project.
If you go back to your last slide, though, you still only have one left turn lane going there with only about 8 cars stacking.
And that.
So one of the things that we looked at basically at this location was to try to provide the necessary improvements to make sure that this was operating at a good level of service. Now, what we identified based on the site plan for this property, what we saw was that the main entrance was actually here. It's a little bit further to the east over here. So not that many people were taking this road. To actually, this was more like a backdoor entrance for the Water Tower Commons development, and the main access was over here. They have 2 access points along Lantana Road, so that is where most of the traffic was going towards. If you look at it also, what we did was to, as I mentioned, having that extra lane in each direction along Lantana Road is able to provide the necessary capacity to be able to accommodate the traffic that is going from there. So we did run all the traffic analysis, and if I actually go back to that intersection would operate at level of service D or better. And that is, as I mentioned to you, this is not for today. This is for 2045, the future year. So when this gets built, it's probably going to operate a lot better. And as traffic grows over 20 years, that's when you're going to get this amount of level of service. So we feel pretty confident that we can be able to accommodate with the design we have there.
Thank you.
One question. You started in January of 19.
Yes.
And you're going to construction in 2029.
Yes.
That's a 10-year period. Why does it take so long to get from conception to construction?
There are a number of things that goes into the when you're developing the plans. As I mentioned, one of the key things that gets into play with all these different projects is the availability of the funds. Sometimes because of a higher priority projects, the funds are prioritized and some of these projects get moved out. Now, it doesn't mean that if the funds become available earlier, they cannot move that. So when you look at this slide over here, you can see that the design and right away gets done by 2023. But the funding for construction is way out in 2029. So that is what we have currently. That is what is prioritized now. If the funds become available earlier, the plans will be ready to move into construction. So that's the way that we've been operating with some of these projects.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes, please. Yeah. So for each of the different possibilities you mentioned, for the first one only, you said that there's a 7-foot bike lane buffered and a 6-foot sidewalk. Is that the same measurement for all 3 options?
It's the same for all of them. Basically, we have a 7-foot buffered bike lane as well as a 6-foot sidewalk on each side of the road.
And there's no room for improvement on that bike lane to make it so it's more than just buffered? While you're doing construction going out, to 2028 when we're hoping people are mobile?
Actually, this is one of the things that has actually come up. And one of the things that, people have been thinking, you know, a lot of different ways with how to accommodate multimodal, you know, modes within these arterials. Some of the ideas that we've actually had has been, what if you even take the bicycle lanes from the roadway and combine them with the sidewalk, make it a shared use, you know, path. You know, that actually allows, you know, people who are more recreational bicyclists to use that a lot more.
Right.
These are all different things that we are actually looking into currently. As I mentioned, this road is it's under the jurisdiction of the county, and based on the, we designed it based on the county's standards, having the 7-foot buffered bike lanes and all of that.
The standards for what year?
Yeah, the county's standard, the current standard.
Current standard?
The current standard.
So are they building to a certain year, though? Because if you're going to have this beginning in 2028, are we building to 2045 standards, or are we building to 2025 standards?
Well, the standards are usually for what is happening right now, but they, sometimes they do change as the years go by.
So, I mean, just if, I, it would just seem that if it's not going to happen until until 2028, we'd go with forward thinking on it.
Yeah,
that we're trying to get people out of cars and go more motor.
That is a point well noted, and as I mentioned, yeah, we're still working with the county together with also going to be reaching out to Palmtran to look at, you know, different modes that we because right now there's no transit within the segment between High Ridge Road and Redding. There is a transit bus stop on the east side here, and then on the west side on the
That's okay.
On the east side over here, and then on the west side over here.
Okay.
But those are not within our principal locations. They only have like a bench and another stop. So with the water tower commons coming in, is there a possibility to convert some of these things to a shelter, things of that nature?
Right.
These are things that we are looking to have that dialogue with.
So, Godfrey, are you saying there's an opportunity for this plan to change to accommodate for more multimodal thinking?
Well, definitely.
Okay, good.
If it's
good.
Something that the county wants and they want to take a look at that, yes. But that is typically what DOT does, is they usually like to partner with the county to be able to implement some of those additional features.
Well, yeah, please do note that I think that most of the folks here would agree with me. That's something, we, if it's this far out, we really need to be thinking that way.
Appreciate it. Well,
any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So now we're going to move to item 3D, which is 3D. Yes. South Florida Regional Transportation Authority update.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. My name is Vince Shulo. I'm with the South Florida Regional Transportation Authority's Outreach Department, here with my colleague.
Good afternoon. Natalie Yesbeck, SFRTA Planning Department.
So thanks for having us. We're going to do a little overview on the Tri-Rail system. I'm sure most of you are familiar with us. The way we kind of broke it out is we're going to talk a little bit about our past, where we are currently, and the things we're working on. Also ways for this board, and you as individuals, to get involved with what we're doing, as well as a quick presentation on our transit asset management plan. So SFRTA, who are we? We operate the Tri-Rail commuter rail service as well as a fixed shuttle network we call our commuter connectors. 72-mile system. We are South Florida's only commuter rail. We have 18 stations throughout the three counties. We connect all three major airports as well as our local transit partners, Palmtran, BCT, and MDT. We run 365 days a year, 50 trains during the weekday, 30 on the weekends. And we're very proud and happy that in 2019, we broke our single-year ridership record, so 4.49 million rides in the calendar year. So I talked at the beginning about how we were going to kind of look at the past, the present, and the future. What have we done? So over the last 10 years, we've done a number of upgrades to the system. If you're a regular rider, you've probably noticed them over time. A bunch of things we listed up there. Some of the high-end ones are in 2010, we upgraded a portion of our fleet. We launched a real-time tracking app, so as a rider, you can get information on our system, where the train is, times to the station. One of our biggest projects in 2015, we opened our Miami Airport station, which we still promote today, and people don't realize that you can take Tri-Rail directly to MIA and not have to really connect at all. You land right at the airport. Wi-Fi on the trains, the commuter connector bus fleet, which we rebranded and got new vehicles in 2017. One of them actually is here at the West Palm Station, and that's what connects riders from the West Palm Beach Station to PBIA Airport. And we also, like I talked about, we got our highest ridership. I think we can contribute a lot of that to our OTP. We've done a lot of capital improvements to the corridor, and in 2018, we reached our highest OTP, 96.6% of trains on time. So who are we? If we were going to take a snapshot of our system, how we serve our passengers, who's on the train, if you're not super familiar with our service, you know, what's the Tri-Rail rider look like? Where are they going? One of the key things we like to point out, if you look at the choice ridership graph right there, the majority of our riders are actually choice riders, which means they have access to a car, but they choose to take the train instead. A lot of times, sometimes the perception of transit is the only folks that use it don't have cars. That's definitely not the case on our system. If you look at the station ranking by activity, this is a very cool one. In 2018, we did our onboard survey, which Natalie's team managed. If you look at those top five stations by boarding, you'll notice that four of the five are actually in Palm Beach County. So Palm Beach County, we have a lot of Tri-Rail riders, very popular here. Also, you look at the origin-destination pairs. Our most popular route, you could say, is between the Fort Lauderdale Airport and the Miami Airport. But those next top two are actually a round trip between Boca Raton and West Palm Beach. So again, it kind of points back to a lot of folks in Palm Beach County are taking advantage of the service. And this is a very interesting one. So when we talk about transportation and planning and how do we make the systems better, first last mile always comes up as an issue, right? How do you get from where you're starting to the train station and then where you're ending? So in that same onboard survey, we highlighted a few of the things in this chart that we thought were interesting. The last time we did it, rideshare really wasn't ubiquitous, like not a lot of people were using it. Now it actually accounts for 10% of our first mile and 10% of our last mile of people going to and from the train stations. Also, we noticed that walking while low getting to a Tri-Rail station is actually pretty high leaving the station. So the last mile getting to where they're going is 23%. As well as we also highlighted our commuter shuttle buses, while getting to our station on them, not so much of ridership, leaving the station and connecting to places of employment is very high. That commuter shuttle program we have primarily connects the stations to various office parks in the area. So it's a lot of your kind of 9-to-5 commuters during the day. So that's why you see that it bumps up there on the from Tri-Rail station. And now I'm going to pass it to Natalie to give a quick overview of some of our current projects we're working on.
So one of our main projects at RTA is our extension into downtown Miami, the Downtown Miami Link, which right now is primarily constructed. Brightline currently operates into downtown Miami, and we look forward to sharing that station with them in the future. Right now, we are awaiting FEC to finish their PTC, their positive train control implementation, which is federally mandated. Once they finish that by the end of this year, they can then invite us onto their railroad and we can begin service. So we anticipate being into our downtown station in 2021. Another project that we have on our horizon is another station along that line in the Midtown Wynwood area. City of Miami, is, along with Miami-Dade MPO, TPO, are very interested in seeing another station come to fruition for Tri-Rail to serve. Once again, we have to have approval by FECR, which is a major hurdle for us, but we are moving forward into environmental of a possible station, so SFRTA is going to be heading that up soon, and hopefully we can move forward with conversations with FECR regarding that station. And another project that's a little bit closer to home for most of you is the new Northern Layover facility. The TPA has had it on their long-range transportation plan for many years, and so we're very thankful for their support. We're finally seeing movement on this, and we hope to have a consultant on board, design-build consultant on board by the summer of this year, designed to be completed by next year, and construction in 2023. And that will move the layover from the current location at the West Palm Beach station, near the West Palm Beach station, over to this new facility. So where do we go from here? Florida is a very attractive economy, South Florida in particular. We have no personal income tax, and South Florida is a national leader in job creation with a 250,000 jobs created last year in Florida, specifically. We lead the state in population, and we continue to grow. So what does this bring us? Traffic, congestion, and we need to address this. We at the RTA see Tri-Rail as one of the solutions to that. We know that $4 for every $4 generated in economic returns for every $1 invested in public transit. We know that every $10 in operating investment for public transit yields $32 million in increased business sales. We know that investing in transportation is good for the for economic development. So we hope that Tri-Rail can continue to be a part of this economic growth of South Florida. We hope to see the advancement of Coastal Link and the Jupiter Extension a little further out, unfortunately, but we still have that on our horizon, and we'd like to see that happen. We have worked to support TOD projects within our agency for the region, and we are committed to improving the system performance of Tri-Rail through reliability improvements, passenger experience overall, and understanding our first and last mile connections and where we need to improve that as well. So that's something else that we look forward to improving. And sustainable funding is something that we have yet to solve. We continue to try to look for that as a long-term solution and not just the stopgap measures, but hopefully that's something that will be seen in a shorter amount of time than long-term.
Last little piece here, we just wanted to highlight. Obviously, you all are familiar with where you are, but the map that TPA put together is awesome, showing all the options. So I took the train here today and walked right to your guys' new lovely office here in downtown. It's very convenient, and you have quite a few mobility options to get from the various points to your office. So what we like to say when we talk about transportation is help be part of the solution, right? It's one thing to, you know, talk about improving the system, and it's another thing to actually be part of it. So you guys, awesome location that you've picked, and it's just a 15-minute walk from the Tri-Rail station right there on West Clematis here to your office. Our agency does actually host a lot of fun events. So when we say ride, we mean ride all different kinds of ways. On the weekends, our fares are only $5 for an all-day pass. It means you can buy a ticket and ride Tri-Rail all day long. And we host about 3 to 4 family-friendly events a year where we promote taking the train, events that we put on, as well as events that are in the community that we partner with. So the recent one, Lake Worth Street Painting Festival, is always a really popular one, and every year we see our ridership on the weekend just keep growing and growing. We provide one of those commuter connector shuttles from our Lake Worth station right to downtown to go to the Street Painting Festival. And so it's just something we like to promote. Down to Miami, Ultra Music Festival, high impact event with a lot of people going to one place. We actually hold trains late at night to be able to bring the kids back from the concert. So just a couple things going on that we do to kind of promote, to introduce people to our system. And feedback. We need it. We want it. There's a lot of different ways to do it. We're pretty active on social media, so please follow us. You're obviously part of a committee here, so that's a great step. We have the PTAC meetings that we host. We have our governing board meetings. As simple as giving us a call or sending us an email, we love to partner with everyone in the community, so please reach out to us. And we're going to roll this right into our transit access management plan, and at the end we'll do questions.
So the transit asset management plan, I'm just going to give just a few slides on this, about the elements and process as well as what RTA has done and how we maintain our plan. So in July 2016, FTA published the transit asset management plan final rule. So this mandates that we as a transit agency have to prepare this plan in order to understand the assets that we have, the number of assets, the condition of them, and plan for their state of good repair over time. For us, our assets are not only our rolling stock, our trains, our locomotives, it's also the rail itself on the corridor, our stations, the vehicles that we use as staff, et cetera. So it's all-encompassing. So this is a tool that helps us plan for the continuation of our service. So these are the elements of a TAM plan. So first you assess your inventory and determine the condition that they are in. And once you have that, you put it into a tool. We have our TransAM tool, which is an online tool that we use, which then utilizes the condition of each individual asset to prioritize it for repair or replacement. So we look at this continuously throughout the year, and then every year we identify how we performed and determine new measures for the next year. So this is basically what I just said, so just for your information. So this is just a snapshot of our assets as an agency right now. We have our rolling stock, which is our locomotives, our passenger coaches, et cetera. The equipment, which is the maintenance vehicles, as well as our pool cars that we use as employees to get to different things and other capital equipment. The facilities, we have two maintenance facilities, as well as our administrative center. We also have 18 passenger stations and their parking facilities near them. Infrastructure is everything to do with the track. So the track, the signals, the system that goes with it. So in 2018 is when we first established our performance measures and targets. So I'm just going to kind of walk you through this a little bit from the top down. So the first one is our first asset class, equipment. The performance measure for those is the useful life. So the useful life of any of our pool cars, for example, is 8 years. So in 2019, we established that we wanted 0% of our pool cars to be over their useful life. Then we went and actually looked at them, and we found that 22% were over their useful life. So we anticipate that we're probably going to have that for next year, as we don't have the budget to replace those. Next, rolling stock. Our rolling stock has a useful life of 39 years. So again, we wanted a lofty goal of 0%, but we found that 25% of our rolling stock has reached the end of their useful life. Now, you can rehabilitate them and put money into them to extend their useful life. And so that's something that we plan to do. It's not simply just replacing things. It's also rehabilitating them. So our performance in 2019 was 25% of our stock was over their useful life. And then our target next year is we anticipate that no additional rolling stock will meet the end of its useful life. For rail, for the tracks, that's measured by slow orders. So whenever you see the train moving and it slows down for no apparent reason whatsoever, there's a reason for that, I promise, and it's a slow order, and that's usually due to construction or something going on that's being replaced on the track where, for safety reasons, the train has to operate at a slower speed. So if our 2019 goal was 8% of the corridor operating with slow orders, but we've actually done a lot of work to our corridor. So it came out that it was only 3% of our, and that was a lot of rail tie replacement and real replacement of our signals and things of that nature that helped boost that. So that came back positive. And then our facilities and buildings, like I said, we have 18 stations, and it's ranked on a 1 to 5 scale. We weren't sure exactly how many would come in under 2.5 on this scale. We hoped for 30% being under, and we were pleased to find out that only one station was under par. So now we plan forward to identify the reasons for that and fix it. So that's how the TAM system works. Basically, it's just a tool to monitor our assets and their condition over time, to track it and plan for the funding that we need to improve them over time. This is something that we have to report to the MPOs every year, and every 4 years we have to completely redo our TAM plan. So this has been our first update to our TAM plan. We're still kind of in the learning process, so it's new to us and it's new to most transit agencies, but it's very useful. So if there's any questions on the TAM plan or any of the other information that we presented.
Sure.
Mine is more of a general statement when you were talking about the uses. I recently, for the first time in my life, went on Tri-Rail. About 3 weeks ago, I took my grandson down to the Fort Lauderdale Airport because I believe my flight left at 5:45 p.m., and I knew without a doubt that somewhere, either by accident or construction, I would not make that flight, no matter what time I left, if I had left at 10 a.m. in the morning. Because if you've ever tried to prepare for a flight out of Fort Lauderdale, it's complicated. So I thought I would relax and take a Tri-Rail ride because I knew it would avoid both of those things. And it was very delightful. I actually enjoyed it. It was comfortable. You know, I think with Brightline coming on, I think it's a good time for you to kind of revamp, relook, reinvest, do some of the things. The refurbishing is always smart. And I wish you all the best. I think this is a really good thing, especially with the direction that the county is moving towards, as well as the metro area. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Well,
I look forward to additional rides. I think Chelsea asked me if I wanted to go on a Tri-Rail ride
with
her.
On ride,
so we're going to go together.
That's great.
Chelsea.
I have way too many. I'll try to make it quick. So with Wynwood going in, and I'm from the north end, so I live in Palm Beach Gardens, so we're desperately awaiting our Tri-Rail station. What have they done right so that places like Jupiter and Gardens can learn from it so that we too can be considered for a stop?
Well, I would say, first of all, there has been a grassroots effort to bring that station in. There's been not just political champions, but also the community really wants it. There's a business improvement district that has been very vocal. We've had landowners, we've had developers, you name it, the full gamut of people come to us and say, what do we need to do? We want a station. That being said, you know, like I mentioned before, as an agency, RTA has committed to moving forward with an environmental process to try to identify a specific station location. And the benefit of that area is that we already have an access agreement with FECR to run our trains on that portion. However, FECR still has to agree to a station location. So
that's a twofold issue.
Right. We have the access, which is huge, because up north we don't have the access.
We're missing access and you're missing the grassroots support as well.
Right. And okay. And right now FECR hasn't been willing to discuss access further north. They're focused on other elements.
All right. That's great. And then I may have missed it. Did you share any of your passenger experience metrics as well? What are the metrics coming back from, like, customer satisfaction? And if I missed it, I apologize.
Yeah, did we have a slide on that, though? I don't think we had a slide on that. But in our 2018 survey, and I can certainly share this if you'd like, in all our surveys, really, we always ask about 20 questions on customer satisfaction. And we have come in consistently better every time, always in the last survey we did in 2018, we asked a new question: would you recommend Tri-Rail to friends or family? Just a yes or no, and you know, 1 to 10 scale, I would recommend or I would not recommend, and we came in at like 9.3 or something.
Oh, that's
like
great.
That.
So what are the biggest customer happy, like, one thing that customers love and one thing they don't like?
buds. So the thing that they love is the convenience. Mm-hmm. The thing that they don't love is actually, I would say, the hours.
Yeah, I would add one thing. So I manage our social media, so I like to think I have a pulse of the ridership. What's very interesting about our system, and you know, you get feedback on social media, a lot of times it can be negative, right? The majority of our feedback is they want the system to expand, and they get frustrated that it's not expanding.
Okay.
That's the struggle. Why?
Good problem, you know, to have.
It's a good problem to have, right? It's tricky because our agency, you know, you only get so much funding to do X, Y, Z, and of course passengers want new stations here, new stations there, more service, but that's kind of the recurring thing I see is they get frustrated when there's an hour-long headway, right? Run more frequent, you know, those kinds of things. That's kind of the primary feedback we get.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question, and I feel like I'm just generally curious since my city has had a lot of train news lately in Boca.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, once the Brightline station goes in downtown, and I realize that both tracks kind of service different areas of Boca. Are you expecting any sort of impact on your ridership from Boca? Because I noticed in one of the slides it shows that you mentioned that the top three origin destination pairs Boca to West Palm and West Palm to Boca. Certainly, it seems like you know, Boca is a popular place to take the tri-rail. What will be the impact once Brightline goes in?
So I think what's interesting in that first slide, I showed that we had our highest ridership year ever, right? So in 2019... highest ridership ever. Over the last 2 years, 2018, 2019, Brightline's, you know, been in the market. A lot of people asked us, were you going to lose ridership or how would that affect us? And if anything, it's brought more ridership to us. So looking at a station in Boca Raton, you know, the area, well-serviced to FAU. We have a huge FAU staff and student population. The Palm Sharon Route 94 connects for free. Directly between our Boca Raton station and FAU, if you just show your ALF card, as well as the Park at Broken Sound and all the businesses that are literally adjacent to the station. It's a huge employer connection for us. Yeah. So, you know, on the eastern tracks, you have more of like the downtown and Meisner Park and walkability. There's definitely a market there, but we've seen ours with some of the new residential going in Park at Broken Sound, plus the businesses, plus the college,
yeah, exactly.
And all that space right there. It's I don't see it being taken away by a new rail station, so.
Right. And just to piggyback off of the student population, not only do we have the students going to the universities, but we also service Bach and Dreyfus schools, and we have a large number of children that get on every day and go to school on our train from Boca and a few stations north. So those, I don't see any of those riders changing over.
Thank you.
Any other questions? With that, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Now we will move to 3B, fiscal year 2021-22, United Planning Work Program.
So that one will become the last one we present on next is Morgan and West Palm Beach Vision Zero.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Vision Zero. Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me today. My name is Wen Deng. I am the city traffic engineer for the city of West Palm Beach. It is a fortunate and unfortunate title of having to be the city traffic engineer. But ultimately, I'd like to present to this board of the city of West Palm Beach Vision Zero policy and strategy. We started back in 2018. It was actually August of 2018. And it was an ad hoc effort really coming out of communications and engineering. And we wanted to battle this whole, epidemic of road safety within the city and, of course, in Florida. So after a year of hard work, we are official as part of the Vision Zero Network here, as shown on map, one of four cities in the state of Florida, and we're really excited to share some of our results. Just to a brief overview, our mayor is really the leader in this effort, and ultimately our task force is made of more than 50 stakeholders in this area. So anybody from FDOT, Palm Beach County, and really the state attorney himself has been part of this this committee. And when we get together, which is once a quarter, we really what we discuss is our champion. What else can we do more? Right? How else? What are we doing as individual entity? And how are we measuring? And how do we work together? The outcome of that is incredible. DOT is a pleasure to work with. They have funded many safety improvements within the city of West Palm Beach and our streets. County has a yellow light flashing program that they're going to replace all 900 intersections in the county. It's really incredible. This conversation has really initiated and started really here with this task force. So in 2019, because we're really only a year old, right? The first 3 months, we're still trying to figure out how do we get funding and what can we do. But in 2019, we hosted over 40 events. And this ranges from block parties, which we give out over 400 helmets in a range of 90 minutes, to really crash reenactments. And what those are is our Vision Zero coordinator. She'll attend a public high school. And they'll reenact what happened when you get into a crash. And we typically like to target that age group, 15 to 19, because those are the highest, as far as the most vulnerable users of the roadway. In addition to that, we do a lot of safety assemblies. We have older driver awareness classes also that we hold out with IBIS. And every time that we hold one of these events, and as you can see, the stakeholders are incredible. It's not just the city staff, but it's FDOT. It's the fire and the police department that's with us every step of the way. And then, of course, the Vision Zero is the three E's, right, in the city, engineer, education, and enforcement. So when we look at enforcement, last year, this is a grant that the TPA has solidified to any community that's interested. But ultimately, we receive about $48,000 last year to supplement our enforcement efforts. And this goes towards really positive and passive enforcement. And we target towards the new texting law, right? We don't text when you're driving, and distracted driving. And ultimately, when you do get pulled over, and one of these police officers are not there to penalize you, but they're there to educate and to talk about the importance of putting away your phone or, you know, be more aware of your surrounding. So because of that, we had a tremendous support in general by our police department. So without our PR and marketing, we really couldn't get the words out. Right? And I think that the most important part about this is public information. We're doing all these great things, and there's only so many amount of staff that could get the words out. But we invest quite a bit in PR in general is because people tend to get their information more differently now than they used to. So it's not just paper and TV, but we specifically target online media. And I think that's really important because right now, average users spend more time on social media, right, on Instagram, Facebook, than they get their news from Channel 25. And that's just how the trend is, and the trend is changing. So we really target social media, and because of this investment, well, we reach more than 3.4 million people through 2019. And then, of course, engineering is probably the most important aspect of it because you have to design your street for a safer speed, and that's how you can encourage safer behavior. But ultimately, we focus on some strategy, and I'm going to go on a very high level. If we want to discuss in details, I'm happy to, and really target around our schools and our kids and the pedestrians because those are the most vulnerable users of the roadway. So traffic calming. It's simple, right? Not a lot of people can identify with bike facilities, amenities, but everybody knows when there's that one car that drives down your street really, really fast, we want traffic calming. So the city has a traffic calming advisory committee and an ordinance that will allow us to install and mitigate some of these issues. So we looked at speed management, we looked at speed management as a real strategy, and we target a series of traffic calming devices, not only upgrade, replace, but also install new. And we target those cut-through streets, right? If you're in east of I-95 here in the city, you're by the railroad, you have a light, people are flooring it once the light turns green. So how do we mitigate those impacts? So in 2019, we programmed, designed, and installed up to 50 speed humps in the city. So with any speed humps, and there's a reason why we've primarily focused on speed humps and really traffic circles, mini circles, and the whole impact of data, right? You have to have good data to make good decisions. So if you look at this FHWA, ITA traffic calming, if you look at the 12 to 14 foot hump yields the highest in changes in 85th percentile speed. So you can really get that speed reduction. The other thing is, if you look at traffic circle, roundabouts traffic circle, it actually has the most capacity. So it actually functions better than an intersection or a signalized intersection or a stop condition itself. So when we look at traffic calming in the city, we highly encourage really speed humps and traffic circle. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, with any traffic calming installation that we have, we're very concerned on how that would affect our emergency services. So in some communities, one of the E's, in all of the E's that we have, is actually emergency services. And it's really important because I want to highlight that it's not easy, right? This is a report that came out of New York City. New York City is a leader in Vision Zero. They've done this the longest out of all the communities in the United States. And the firefighter unions come out and said that, hey, our response time is longer. That's not good. But then, you know, there's other factor may come into play, like construction, or there's rideshare vehicles, Uber and Lyft, people taking up the curbside. So with that, we couldn't have done our reports and looking at our data without working with our own emergency response team. So we did our drive along ride-by with our fire department really only a couple weeks ago. We looked at five different locations in the city, primarily the same average length in section, and then we looked at all the different traffic calming that we have. If you guys have not been in the city of West Palm Beach, I'd like to invite you. I'll show you all the devices that we have. We have from median dividers, chicane, table intersection, mini rounds, everything you can think of the manual is somewhere in the city. But we looked at the average speed that our the vehicles are going through or traversing through our street, and then the average time that it takes to go through the section. It's actually not it's not bad because they're not going any faster. They target 25 miles an hour because these are local streets. They're not major collector road. The other thing that is I find it very interesting as we're learning about this is the biggest, as we interview our fire department, the biggest challenge to response is not traffic calming. It's actually tree branches that needs to be trimmed, sign placements, and those are signs that's being placed at the intersection, so it's very hard for them to make a left or right turn. And then lastly are potholes. If you have ever had a chance to do a ride-along in the vehicle, it is very bumpy as they're cutting through the potholes. Of course, some of the other things that we want to identify, crowded streets, like if you have high utilization rates, and when I think of high utilization is like when you have more than 50% of the street with parked vehicles, it's very hard for them to get through. In my world, I think narrow street, high utilization parking streets are slow streets and actually a good thing. So we have to find that balance. They also preferred bike facilities, right? So sometimes in our community, we hear, I don't want a bike lane. I don't want anybody biking. Now, nobody's going to bike there anyway. But when you have a bike lane, you don't have on-street parking. So during an emergency response, it's actually faster and easier for them, the fire department, to get to its destination. So that was one of the comments that they gave us. And then ultimately, and this is also very, very important, speed humps need to have signs and proper warning signs. Because if you look into the manual, the MUTCD Chapter 2C.29, I believe, if you have a vertical deflection in the road, you have to have some kind of warning sign. And that's why most of the signs, and I'm only telling you this because some of the comments that I've received is that we are a historic neighborhood. We are grandfathered in for not having signs on our bumps. Well, speed bumps are not historic, so let's have signs because it's the safest thing that we could have in our community. And then ultimately, we have to look at the data. And if you go back to the data, and these are the data where our medical and our fire calls are within the city. It's about 80% of the calls are medical related and 20 are fire calls. And so I want to point out the fire calls are typically in the downtown area. You see the hot spot right there by our fire station. So we have formed, or we are forming, a road closure committee to talk about how do we better coordinate where constructions, or if there's events, or if there's road closure in general. The other thing that we have made recommendation on, our fire chief is considering, is smaller tiller trucks. As our roads are getting more narrow, more walkable, more walkable friendly, we need vehicles that would accommodate those type of road section. And then medical calls are primarily north of the city. And then with that, we know that we need to dedicate additional points because we have asset management as we look at how do we prioritize potholes and road resurfacing, right? And so this is something that's going to go into next year's cycle as we program our road resurfacing program. So how do we add more points into areas identified by our fire department? So this is a very high level of what can we do with our data that was presented to us. And then speed control. So road design, right? We try to look at what are some innovative road design that we are, whenever we're doing road improvements in general. So this is the intersection of Cumberland Drive and Saratoga out in the Villages. It is, this is one of those requests that came into me about 6 years ago, 5.5 years ago. And somebody, it was a simple request, like, oh, they're speeding on my road. No problem. After exploration and after we look at safety data and crash data, we deemed that we need a roundabout at this intersection. And then we add a little bit more to it. We looked at how do we provide complete streets, okay, because complete streets are safe streets. And so we designed it for a protected roundabout and a protected bike lanes on both sides of the road. With that, there's a fire station right on this street also, so we really take into a lot of that into consideration with lighting. And really, this is probably the first protective roundabout that we have in Palm Beach County, so we're very proud of it for bike access. We also work with AIPP, which is Art in Public Places. It's an ordinance that the city has, like 1% of all development goes into art installation. And instead of putting planting in the middle of the roundabout, we work with AIPP to install an art exhibit. So it becomes a really nice focal point and a place. But as you can see, the 85th percentile speed has decreased tremendously. And because of that, we have not had any reported accidents. But I can't brag. This has only been open a month. So, but ultimately, I want to point out we still have very high crash corridors in the city. There are three very, I would say three areas in the city of West Palm Beach that we identify as the highest crashes or most severe crashes. North Broadway, 45th Street by Military, and of course west of Okeechobee. And there's no doubt these are major arterial roads that connect us to I-95. But then, if we look at the data, we got to look at why are we still number one in the most dangerous places for pedestrian, right? And so we have to make really, really hard decisions. And this is Broadway itself. We look at what is Broadway today, four lane divided. Can we create a vision that is more complete, that will still preserve capacity for roads? So it's a very challenging ask of our community, but we are asking for a lane elimination project here. And if you look at the accidents data along this corridor, 33% of the accidents on here are pedestrian and bicyclists. And that's the reason why we have to make this hard decision. But ultimately, as you can see, our policy is always to provide a protected bike lanes whenever we can. And that could also be something that's shared among with the pedestrian. You can find a design very similar to this and right in front of the Kravis. It's just recently done a few months ago. So the next time you visit the Kravis, enjoy the front by Okeechobee. That's an FDOT roadway. And they have permitted us to do that type of design. Because of that, we have programmed other major infrastructure projects that's very similar. We're going to put the bikes with the people and not with the cars. And then kind of a big, really a recap of what we've done in 2019 here. Speed hump program, we didn't have a program before, but because of that, we looked at proactively looking at reduction of speed. Yield streets, which are what we called curbless streets, we completed two. Clematis is right one block away, and of course, Rosemary Square. That is a redevelopment effort that we work with the developer to create the same feel. We have 31 school zones in the city of West Palm Beach, and all by federal mandate, we have to upgrade all 31 school zones. So we finished design, we finished all the coordination, we actually finished 5 out of the 31 school zones. So in 2020, our goal is to finish it, even though they extended the deadline, but it's okay. We're proactive. And then, of course, a citywide lighting program. And, you know, back in, I guess, like 3 years ago when we had the penny sales tax, we identified a funding source to upgrade lighting citywide, but we didn't know where to prioritize all that investment. So ultimately, we looked at, we have a lighting study that looked at low-income connectivity to transit, low car ownership, like, you know, low walkability. And those are the type of neighborhoods that we're targeting. We also finished 10 miles of bike facilities last year. And just to let you guys know, that's 20% of our entire network. So even though the city of West Palm Beach is the largest city in the county, we only have 50 miles, you know, up to 2018. So 10 miles is a lot for us, and that will help. And as you can see, we use Zikla separator as the protection. And then lastly, ADA. You know, ADA by means, like, we have these type of sidewalks everywhere, tripping hazards, and we want to to proactively not only upgrade all the curb ramps, but also all the sidewalks that is high impact, that could be a tripping hazard. So we invested approximately $1 million last year on just concrete flat work. That's quite a bit. And then here are some data, right? Is it working? Yes. The answer, short answer is yes. And it's not all engineering. It is a community effort. So the healthcare district, which is part of our committee, our task force, they release data, and these are data that is transferred to St. Mary's Hospital. And as you can see, they compare at the end of 2018 to the 2019. So that's our benchmark, right? And as you can see, that the motor vehicle versus pedestrian, which is very important, and that is a car versus a person, has gone down. And also, when we look at the City of West Palm Beach Police Department data, the HVE is the area that we're targeting, the three segments that I talked about earlier, it also went down. But given said that, the ped bike crashes are still very high. 20 is still a lot, and our goal is zero. So it's a very aggressive goal, and we're hoping that it will continue to decline from year to year. So something that's really fun with me. This is an inspiration for me. I was told by our then assistant city administrator that, hey, you know, there's this park in Europe that kids learn to ride bikes and they learn all the road rules. I'm so jealous. So I actually went to visit one myself, and it was incredible to see how great is it that we look at teaching kids at an adolescent's age. And because of that, I started working with the school board. And it really started from a a working group in this same room that we were able to make this connection. And so I identified a location that within the school board property that we could do something like this. And it's actually at Palmetto Elementary School. It's right off of Parker and Palmetto. They have a green space that I guess previously it was used for dog walking, and let's try to make better use of that space. So, you know, I mocked something up. This is a draft, like designed something and said, hey, let's look at what we call this, a traffic garden. But, you know, if we want to give it an official name, it's the Vision Zero Safe training course. And this, not only that this is for the community, and my thought is that this is for kids, because this is an elementary school, as an extracurricular safety program. And the school board liked it so much that they are thinking about how do they create field trips and training program, educational program out of this. So right now we're still in the planning phase, but this is really exciting, and I'm hoping that this will be a reality for all of us. So this concludes my presentation. So if you guys have any questions, I'm here to answer.
Any questions?
Fantastic job.
Yeah.
Very good. Excellent.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And lastly, we have 3B. Which is the fiscal year 21-22 Unified Work Program.
Good afternoon. I'm Matthew Kama, the CFO for the Palm Beach TPA, and I'll be presenting our draft Unified Planning Work Program. We like to call it the UPWP because acronyms are our favorites. I'll be short and concise because this is an overview. There's much more to look at, and we have put it up on the website to review further, and then there'll be, if you want to ask any questions, we can get to that too. But we'll keep it short and sweet for now. The UPWP is our business plan, our budget, and our application for federal grant funds. It's really what drives how we do our business and how we serve the public. We cover a period of 2 years. It's a two-year cycle beginning July 1st of 2020 and concluding June 30th of 2022. We use this document to identify what's going to happen. So we identify the deliverables. We call those deliverables or outcomes. What products are we going to finish and provide? Who's going to do that work? Who will it be assigned to, whether it's staff or consultants or a combination thereof? And we put in targets to help drive our efforts. And lastly, is how do we pay for it? How do we get that done and make it happen? We have six core tasks that we identify: engage the public, plan the system, prioritize funding, implement projects, collaborate with partners, and administer the agency. We use these six as a focus point. We go much further in depth in how we perform the metropolitan planning process, but these help us focus our efforts. We have a roughly $3.5 million budget, and we increase to 3.6 next year, and we'll see a breakdown of the pie here in the next slide. Our major expense, starting out as personnel and benefits, just part of the planning process. It's really our team that has to get that done. We do plan to be fully staffed in this next year, and at an intern position as well. In addition, we do travel and training both for board members and for our staff to be the best at what we can provide. We serve with consultants and plan and budget for that, and then we have direct expenses related to the office space here and the other requirements that we have. In addition to those expenses, we do collaborate or work with CEFTEC and FDOT for the regional demand model, and we do transfers related to that which are reflected in transfers to other agencies. And the last line you see are local funds, that we do collect funds from member dues, and we use those. On the next slide, I'll demonstrate. These local funds are, we have a little more, we can use them in different ways than the grant funds to accomplish that metropolitan planning process. First, we have maximize agency effectiveness. And really what we mean when we say our effectiveness is how do we reach the furthest that we can, both with lobbyists and advocacy. We also do some additional training, and if we involve staff time with advocacy, it has to be reflected there. We've done, we did a peer exchange recently, other activities like that. Second comes improve the public engagement. When we do promotional items and things of that nature, it has to come from these local funds. Sponsorships that we do on a limited basis with other agencies. And then lastly is enhancing staff performance. Certifications and member dues, things like that, fall under this category. And then meeting refreshments, things like that, that we provide. When we bring this draft today, really what we're seeking from you is input. If you have things that you'd like to see us doing, you want us to focus in some area that matters to you specifically, let us know. Corridor studies, action plans, safety studies, we want the input. That's what we're here for. So, like I said, it's a short presentation of overall what we're doing because it is an in-depth document, but it's posted on the website to review further, and the final is planned for adoption in May. So we do invite your comments. Do you have any questions now?
Tina.
I just wanted to know if there's any consideration as far as the TPA is concerned as moving people from the Western community so that we don't have to drive when we come into the East. I really hate driving, and I would rather use public transportation. It was wonderful, you know, being able to get on the train and bus in Europe. Is there any consideration that we can do that here?
Absolutely.
I don't want to use the bus here, but if we can have a people mover somehow, put them in between, you know, the lanes in Okeechobee to bring us east.
So when we develop the LRTP and the TIP, when we look at each of these plans that is really our core products as an agency, those things are evaluated each time and on a continual basis of how do we involve transit, how do we improve that service and make it available to everyone in the community, because that's really what we do is connect communities. As far as the specific plan or how that's happening, that I would refer to the LRTP and the plans that are there, because we do studies and there will be additional corridor studies coming up.
Yeah, I guess my question falls on the corridor studies, if there's going to be one to evaluate something of that nature.
Matthew, I can finish that. Yep, so actually our next corridor study is going to be at Utah Boulevard. So we completed, I'm not sure if that, but 2 years ago, we completed a US 1 multiple corridor study, which went the entire length of our county. We're doing a corridor study to look at all types of multimodal improvements on Okeechobee. And the term for that is around Wellington Mall all the way to downtown West Palm Beach. So that'll be our next corridor study. And then in our LRTP, as he referenced for 2045, we have multiple east-west corridors and a few north-souths that will all be. That all have planned for quarter studies in the next few years. We'll be kicking off Okeechobee, you know, being the CPWD this coming year. So, and then we'll be looking at a few other quarters as well.
You said that's going to go to basically State Road 7.
Yeah, and we're actually we're working closely with Palmtran, who's also going to be using their consultants on part of the study for some of the transit piece. So the idea is that it would go to State Road 7 and potentially a connection to the Wellington Mall, too. So the scope is still to be determined, but definitely from State Road 7 to downtown West Palm Beach.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Any member comments? None. Summary points from the February 20th governing board meeting. Does anybody have any question on those? If not, we'll continue. The January 2020 public involvement activity report has been provided. Does anybody have any questions about that particular study and report? Nope. The next meeting is April 3rd, which is on Friday. Because of the conflict with the Palm Beach County Transportation Summit on April 1. Any other questions? Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.